Hello, and welcome to another edition of Kaleidoscope. This is Magda Zenon, recording from downtown Nicosia. And with me from London, I have Veronica Blecker. Welcome, Veronica.
Thank you so much, Magda, for having me on today.
Veronica, to introduce you to the listeners, you are a Swedish-Swiss documentary filmmaker who focuses on human rights and women's stories. And today we will be speaking about Not Ours to Carry, which is your most recently completed documentary. Tell us about it.
Yes, thank you so much. And the most recent documentary I just completed in 2026 is called Not Ours to Carry, as you so wonderfully introduced. And it's about the Tigray conflict and more so about the women of the Tigray conflict.
To interrupt you, Veronica, we need to say that Tigray, which is in Ethiopia, is one of the most underreported conflicts in the world. In fact, most people have not heard about it, and the extent of the sexual violence against the woman and using women's bodies as a battlefield is beyond horrific. We need to put that context, because we all hear about Gaza and Yemen and Syria, and I'm not underplaying what's happening there, but there are other equally horrific conflicts going on around the world, and I'm glad you brought this to light, because we need to be talking more about the invisible conflicts. So take it from there. I needed to put in the context.
Great. Thank you. And I think that's really important to highlight. Of course, it's really great when, you know, conflicts get highlighted, but there's a lot of them that are left behind. And that's what I felt with this one. And I mean, just the fact that up to 350,000 women were sexually abused and that was used as a weapon of war during this conflict felt too significant to just leave out of our world's history and of our world's media. So that's really why I started making this documentary. So just to give a bit of, you know, context of the conflict, as you so rightfully put, it is a conflict that happened in the north of Ethiopia in a region called Tigray. And in 2020, when we were going through COVID, the north of Ethiopia, Tigray, was at war with the federal government of Ethiopia, as well as Eritrea. So they were in the middle of these two areas and were attacked from both sides. Like a sandwich, yes. So on the same day as well, the whole internet and communication network was cut off. So Tigrayans had no way of communicating with the outside world what was happening. And the only way they could really flee was to go to Sudan. So many fled to Sudan.
Another equally underspoken about conflict, but that's another story.
Definitely. And I think, you know, 21 million people are in need of humanitarian aid.
Basic humanitarian aid, like water, food, and being safe, not anything luxurious.
Exactly, for sure. And so the war lasted for 2 years, pretty much our main COVID years. And so from 2020 to 2022, and rape was really used as a weapon of war and of mass destruction. So behind the longest communication blackout in modern history, it became one of the most systematic campaigns of sexual violence of the 21st century. And as I said before, up to 350,000 women were sexually abused. I mean, these numbers are crazy. And behind that number, it's one woman's story, you know? So I think that's something we always have to remember, that behind numbers, these are actual lives. An actual generational trauma that gets passed on.
I think we underplay the multi-generational trauma, because it's not just the woman that's raped, and we can't underplay of how horrific that must be. But it's like throwing a pebble into the lake. You get ripples around it. It's the family, it's the husband, it's the children, it's the community, it's her personal health. So I think we underestimate what's underplayed of how horrific rape is.
100%. And it's also something that is intentionally done by the perpetrators. I mean, the war also killed up to 600,000 people, which also, I guess, the world has kind of missed. But this effect is really a ripple effect, as you just so beautifully
and
put.
Can I track you there again? Sorry to interrupt you. Mm. I spoke recently to two women that are part of an initiative of non-state violence, okay? And part of that is differentiating between violence and abuse. Violence and torture. And rape, in the cases like the ones that are committed during wartime, are torture because they are actually committed with intention. They're actually committed. The people that are committing it are getting enjoyment out of it. They're doing it intentionally to hurt the other person. It's not like violence or abuse. That's a power game. They're enjoying it. It's a game. So to me, I think we need to separate of the one is a torture because it's been done by community militias and it's not the state. And the other one is abuse. Both are equally horrific. Okay. But this kind of abuse is actually torture because it's done intentionally to watch the other person, to enjoy the other person being hurt.
Yes, and yeah, it's really horrendous. Thank you, Magda. That's a really important input. And well, these women also, after the war had ended, they really didn't, the violence against them didn't really end, because when the war ended, survivors faced a second violence, and that is stigma and shame, and the fact that the world looked away. So their own communities really didn't want to, you know, couldn't be empathetic because they didn't know how to. So it was really so that the women wanted to hide the fact that they had been violated in such a horrendous way. And that really is the second violence that they faced, that they weren't able to heal from this. And there was only really one safe space they could go to, and that's the one-stop centers that are so underfunded. Mm. And also many of them, health centers were destroyed during the war. So there was really nowhere really to go. And in Tigray and in Ethiopia in general, religion is really the spine of the society. So feeling that you're not welcome in church, because as one survivor so tragically puts, that you can't dance with angels anymore because you're dirty now. That is really so heartbreaking, and it's really causing the violence to continue. And I think that that's something, you know, that perpetrators really know, that it's not just about, you know, hurting the society by killing people in the society, but really traumatizing the generations to come. Because many of the survivors, of course, if they can't talk about it, they act out in different ways. Like one of the survivors, she, you know, started hitting her children. And, you know, the ripple effect of that is, of course, violence meeting violence. And it's really sad. It's really sad.
How did you come into contact with the story? Why did the story touch you?
Of course. Thank you, Magda. I'm just rambling on.
I'm understanding your rambling because this, there are so many, I mean, that thing that you said that she can't dance with the angels if she's been dirtied, yet she's carrying the shame, yet the shame shouldn't be hers. And we've understood this recently more loudly with the Gisèle Piquet case in France. And as you said, also church is the, keeps the community together in a lot of these cultures. So by not being able to participate in your community, which is the actual intention of the perpetrators, it's to break the community apart as well. Anyway, I don't mind you rambling. We want to bring visibility as much as we can. So tell me how this came to your attention.
Of course. So I had already been working with an Ethiopian charity that is Swiss-based, but they work with midwives in Ethiopia over the years. And I was working with them as a filmmaker. And through that organization, I made friends with three girls or women that were based in Addis Ababa, the capital of Ethiopia, which is pretty much in the center of the country. And they were, during when the war started, they were in the capital and couldn't reach their families and their friends in the north of the country, Tigray, because it was being, you know, occupied and attacked, and the communication was completely shut off. So they were telling me about that they were hearing words that were coming out of the region because some people had escaped and they were hearing that, you know, their neighbors, their best friends were being sexually abused in such horrendous ways. And so as the conflict continued, they were just keeping me updated. And after a while, when the conflict then had ended after 2 years, the numbers started tickling out of the conflict. And I mean, I couldn't ignore those. They were, you know, in the thousands, and I couldn't read them in the news in the Western media. There was really not a lot of coverage on this conflict and of what the women had endured. So then I, together with their help, went up to the north of Ethiopia, to Tigray, and started documenting and taking testimony of the women who had endured this violence. And I met three amazing women called Rita, Birhan, and Berkti, who aren't themselves survivors, but they were actively fighting both on the world stage, at the UN, at the African, you know, Commission of Human Rights, but also locally against the stigma. So they were really making sure that the voices and the stories of these women were documented and trying to get it heard that this was happening in Tigray, whilst, you know, the world was not listening. So that's really how I got to the story. And these are the three protagonists in the documentary, which are all incredibly bright and passionate and energetic women, which I had the privilege to follow. And they, you know, gave me access to their lives, which I'm extremely thankful for.
But that's
for.
How you also got the idea to... Because when you have this kind of story, the assumption is that you're going to speak to survivors only. But you actually gave the other perspective of women speaking and saying, since they can't speak, we've got to speak about it because we know about the silence, but we shouldn't be carrying the silence. And I think it's a really creative way of doing things because you don't just want to... people to feel sorry. You want to raise awareness, so you want to give a more three-dimensional viewpoint, because I think most documentaries like yours are not intended to just pull the violent heartstrings and make people cry, but it's more to make raise an awareness. So tell me how that worked out, because having seen the documentary, I have to say it was really nicely done, because it was informative, it was heartbreaking, it was authentic, but it was also well balanced and informed. And I think that's a good way. I think it's what documentaries should be. It's not about just saying, look what happened, look what's happened, cry. It's look what's happened. I'm also telling you what's happening, and let's do something about it.
Yeah, I think hope is always so important. And I think that women fighting for women is so important. And that's something that I saw in, you know, the women that are the protagonists, that they are just so strong and really fighting for their communities and fighting for women's rights in a community that has been so scarred. And I think that if you would have centered the documentary on the survivors, it would have firstly put them in danger because, you know, it's small communities, they might be recognized, they might be cast out of their communities. There's just so many consequences to that that are... not, you know, I think ethical in a way. So we did film the testimonies, but they are anonymous. And we also, you know, protected the survivors by changing their voice, by changing the colors of their clothes, so they wouldn't be identified in their communities.
Why does color make a difference? I found that quite interesting. Why does color identify me within the Tigray community?
So because some of these women are also displaced, they only have one, you know, dress that they wear on a daily basis. Yeah. So that means that they would be easily identified. So you would have to change the way their clothes look during the testimonies. And then, of course, you know, when it comes to the women that are part of the documentary, they're already outspoken. So they know the risks that are involved. Of course, it is as a filmmaker's responsibility to make sure that there's not a heightened risk to them. And you always have to be there for them. You always have to discuss with them what might be a consequence of them appearing in the film. But that is something that, you know, they are aware of. So the reason why we then centered the film on these women is really to show the empowerment of women more than just, we don't want to victimize anyone. These women, also the women that survived this violence, they're some of the strongest women I've ever met, you know. So it was really important for me as a filmmaker not to victimize and to really empower.
But that's exactly what I got from it, that you want to talk about it, but these are not victims, these are survivors, which means they have strength. Correct. And it didn't destroy them. They need help, of course, and they need support, but it didn't destroy them, and they're back, and they're strong. Tell us about these three women that were your, main narrators of during the documentary.
Yes, thank you. So the first one I got in touch with was Birhan. And Birhan was in Mekele, in the capital of Tigray, of, you know, the north of Ethiopia during the war. And as she says herself, this could have happened to me. I was just lucky that the rape did not happen to me. And so she also has a partner who just left one day to join the fighting against the federal army and Eritrea. So she was left alone pretty much and just hoping that her partner was safe because she couldn't communicate with him. And just looking out for her and the women in her community. So there's a lot that went on throughout those years that is hard to talk about. But also, once the fighting was over, her number one priority was to take care of the survivors' mental health. So she would go out and document testimonies, but also be there as an emotional support for these survivors because they have no one to talk to.
And her work
has been so significant.
Also, talking to survivors, you need to have certain skills. It's not as simple as having a listening, which most of us can do. It's also knowing how to manage the outbursts or the crying or the silences. So, I mean, that takes a special skill, and kudos to her for doing it, because I'm sure a lot of it, you need to also manage not absorbing all the energy that they're giving off.
Yes, exactly. Which I think is easier said than done. I mean, that this really impacted her. And I think that, you know, if you stay in Tigray, there's a collective trauma kind of. And when you leave, which she did, she went on to study now recently in the US, I think it catches up to you. You know, when you're out of the situation and you have time to reflect and think and you have time to dream, that's when it all catches up to you. And that's something she's actually experienced, and she talks openly about this. So she's been really a fantastic person for survivors to come to and talk to. And she's so empathetic, a wonderful human being. And then aside from her, we have Berhti, who was actually a female soldier during the war. So she was actively fighting, documenting, you know, different medical issues that were arising during the conflict as well. And she left to fight so she wouldn't get raped, because she knew that if she would just sit back, she was waiting for it to come instead of going at it head on.
I mean,
extremely strong.
What an alternative: fight in a war or get raped. I mean, options. Are those really options? But admirable that she did it. And I mean, maybe not everyone can, but when you've got the alternative that you're going to be raped and maybe not more than once, then fighting is not really a bad idea, because at least it's your decision.
Exactly.
Okay, so carry on. Tell us more about her.
Yes. Yeah, so she actually comes from, you know, quite a good position family in Tigray, and they run a hotel and a traveling agency. So when she joined the fighting, she joined with her brother, as well as her partner, who both sadly, tragically, passed away during the war. But yes, she is so strong, and she has, so much that she's fighting for, especially on the ground against stigma. That is really her priority. She is trying to work with her community to combat the stigma so the women don't get re-traumatized. So she's really doing a wonderful job at that, having workshops, you know, going and speaking and trying to get the empathy running through the men's and the community's veins, which she's doing so beautifully. And then the last, the third protagonist is Rita. And Rita is a, she grew up in Manchester, actually. So she is quite the Brit. But once the Tigray War started, she went to Sudan, where the biggest concentration of Tigrayans had fled the war. And she worked there for a year at a refugee camp with, you know, no resources. It was so underfunded. She was living in really harsh conditions, but her focus was to document the stories and the realities of the women that had fled. So she then wrote a book, which I read, and that's how I contacted her. And I actually got to stay with her in Tigray. And we became great friends as well throughout this process. And she's a wonderful human who's fighting on the world stage for these women to be heard. So she's spoken at the UN, at the African Commission, and she's really trying very hard for justice to be served in this community, which is sadly proving harder than one would hope.
We do know that, as I said earlier, the conflict all over the world. How can you ensure you're going to get airtime with anyone? You've got to talk, you need money, you need to be connected. It's not an easy job. So like everyone else, she does the best she can, and I'm sure she's doing great, but things like this documentary also help because they spread the word within the community. Another thing I noticed with your documentary is that you also use animation. And I found that very interesting because I think it changes the visuals that you're seeing, and it gives it another dimension. Why did you choose to use that medium? Also use that medium.
Yes, thank you. So I think that the animation actually elevates the film to a whole different level. And I'm so thankful to the animator, who's called Gabrielle Tesfaye. She is so incredibly talented, and she's from Tigray, but grew up in the States. The reason why we went with that creative choice is because of the communication blackout. And there was no documentation or very limited documentation of what happened when the war broke out. So whenever the three protagonists or the survivors talk in the past form, that soundtrack kind of comes to life. So either when the war broke out or before this tragedy of, you know, sexual violence happened to them. We see that in the very classic and beautiful Tigrayan animation that Gabrielle Tesfaye really brought to life. And I think that's such a powerful medium because you really get another understanding of the Tigray culture, because there's so much of that she includes in her hand drawing. So that's the reason we chose that, because of the communication blackout and there being limited documentation and video footage.
I mean, I like what you said about the fact that it also brings to life the Tigrayan culture and the color of a full color and dimension of the Tigrayan culture. Didn't it also help you to not always focus on the woman speaking? So in that way, keep them anonymous.
Yes, exactly. I mean, definitely. So also because these women, you know, they had complete lives before this happened to them. And many of them are sadly, you know, displaced and are living in camps, IDPs, internally displaced camps, that have very limited resources. So keeping them anonymous is extremely important because all they really want is to get back on their feet. And this could, of course, hurt them doing so if they were recognized.
I think another thing before we get to what you've done with the documentary, actually making relationships before you make the documentary, because for you to step into this kind of context, it's not just, hi, I'm Veronica, I'm a documentary maker, I'm good at my job, I want to do this. You have to develop trust. People need to trust you, and you need to trust them, because it's also about getting the right, not the right information, the reliable information, because we know people often use Westerners to get out wrong messages. How does that work? It always fascinates me about, because one assumes that it's a 40-minute documentary. It probably took you 2 or 3 months. And it's not as simple as that. Because this relationship building is quite an important part of starting the project.
No, I mean, that's so correct. And it did not take 2 or 3 months. It took 2.5 years, which people might think is crazy for a 40-minute documentary. But it is really the trust building. It is making sure you make and create this film with the right people. And for me, as you know, a white Swedish-Swiss person going to Ethiopia, it is important that the community also trusts me and that I'm not telling it from my perspective, but that they are really telling it from their perspective, and I'm just a tool to get it out there. That's all I am. And I think that keeping it authentic to them is the most important. And in order to do that, I also have to understand the context. I have to understand the Tigrayan community, the culture, the religion, and also, you know, how women are seen in the community, how church plays into that, how, you know, hospitality plays into that, how their history plays into that. So really bonding and staying with and living with all these women and protagonists was so important to really build that trust. And it takes a long time to do the research and development and really make sure that these are the right characters for this film. You said that so beautifully, that is really important, the trust building. And also for them to trust me, you know, it takes time.
But exactly, they've got to be sure that you're not just this white woman, Western woman, that's going to use their conflict to make your name. It's about trusting you to tell their story, okay, to be sensitive to their issues. Before I go a step further, these three women that helped you, how were they funded? Because this takes, I mean, as much as we've all done volunteer work, it takes time and it takes resources, because if you just put the basics of your time and petrol to come and go and a basic cup of coffee when you're talking to someone, it can amount to a lot of money. And not all of us have the resources, and nor should we, because we're giving something that we... So how did this... Was there funding or was it a project-based funding?
For my film specifically or for their independent work?
For your film specifically, because I know I know that they must be doing a lot of project work. They have to be. Because no, I wish they paid for stuff like this. With your, for your project, were they funded or did they continue using their, the projects they were actually working in?
So in documentaries, you don't pay anyone, right? So there is no... Because then it can be seen as performative, and that's a real ethical question. So you would never pay anyone to participate in your documentary. The way I funded, you know, my trips going there, then the editor and the local producers, it was all self-funded. So I self-funded this documentary. And when it comes to the work of the three protagonists, they did that with NGOs across the world, where they... did, you know, courses on how to collect testimony so it can be heard in international court. Birhan has done that education as well as, I think, Rita. And then they also get sponsored by different NGOs to carry out the work with survivors and to establish, you know, groups that are support groups. So it's all, you know, funded through different NGOs, many Irish, actually, which was beautiful to see. And then, the documentary itself was self-funded.
Hey, I think people need to understand that it's not a money-making business.
Definitely not.
A lot of it is self-funded. A lot of it is volunteer and that's why you need trust relationships, because people will do volunteer work within your project. So they need to trust the fact that you're going to be authentic and honest in what you're telling them and what you're going to develop. How did you cope with all the things that you heard? Because it's a challenge. Did you get help? Were you also seeing a psychologist on the side?
Yes, I definitely was. So I think when I was in Tigray and hearing all of this, it was obviously extremely hard. But you're in such a fight kind of mentality that you don't really realize it, because everyone is in such a fight mentality. You're in a collective. And I think the real challenge was really coming back to London and realizing all the resources I had and all the privilege I lived with on a daily basis that I, you know, just take for granted. And understanding that, you know, these two worlds live and are simultaneous to each other, that was really the hardest concept to come to terms with. So I definitely saw a psychiatrist for the entirety of the project. Yes.
Oh, I mean, I assumed you would, because as much as you, it's not happening to you, I don't know about you, but I'm an empath, and a lot of the time I absorb stories. I mean, even watching a documentary, watching a documentary or listening to someone else speaking, I go home and I'm depressed, or I feel my body energy down. So I'm glad you did get psychological support.
It was needed.
It was needed. You need to stay healthy as well. The documentary is finished. Where did you first show it? Because I'm assuming you needed to have a launch or a premiere, but you needed to show it.
Yes, so I held a private screening, invitations only, for 100 guests here in London in the beginning of 2026, where I invited NGOs and activists. And then we had a panel afterwards where Rita attended as well, one of the protagonists, which was wonderful, and another expert called Chessie Baldwin, who's part of the gender studies department of a university here in the UK. And that's where we showed it the first time, which was a wonderful evening just for us all to come together. And then right now we're in the process of applying to festivals. And so that is something we're focused on, but we're also focusing on screening it with NGOs. Because, of course, many NGOs work with these kind of issues, but it's mostly, you know, report writing and looking at numbers and all of that. But it's, I think, very important to see the humans behind those numbers. And I think that's what this film so beautifully does. It really shows the faces behind the numbers and the fights these communities are faced with, and the empowerment that is needed for this community, for it really to, you know, change its course and for it to hopefully reach a brighter future. So yeah, we're trying to do a lot of community and NGO screenings at the moment.
What happened at the first private screening? What was the reaction? What kind of atmosphere was it? Because I'm assuming you had a question and answer period after the screening. What was the general feeling?
Yeah, I mean, it was such an interesting, you know, I guess, atmosphere, because many of these NGOs, of course, work with survivors, but many didn't know or understand the scale of it as well. And I mean, it was some of my friends as well that I had invited that are filmmakers. But the fact that they also even didn't know what had gone on is really shocking, because they obviously work in this space. So I think it was a very informative evening for many people living here in the UK. And that was really beautiful to see them being interested and being involved and asking questions about what was happening to these women and what was happening on the international level with this conflict, which is sadly not a lot.
I think that's the saddest part, that nothing's actually happening, because technically the conflict's over, but the rape hasn't really stopped. And there's no support, no real support for the survivors. I mean, the mere fact that humanitarian aid is still having difficulty getting through speaks for itself, because dealing with rape victims is almost a luxury when you don't have water or food or shelter. So I think it's underestimated that you think a conflict's over, the rape's over, so it's over. But it's not. I mean, we've seen it in Gaza, that technically there's a ceasefire. It doesn't work. I think people can be simplistic, because sometimes looking at it three-dimensionally is a bit overwhelming.
No, exactly. And I think in the Tigray context, you know, that rape became somehow normalized in a way. And now it's not just happening, you know, It wasn't just happening during the war. Now it's happening in their own community. And that's the reason for that is it's multifaceted. You know, Tigray was really booming, doing so great before the war. And there were so many opportunities. And now it's really quite ruined. There's not a lot of jobs. The inflation is so high. So, you know, many men get frustrated. The only way they can take out their anger is on the woman. And it's really, really sad. There's not a lot of safety. People are afraid. So it's just a vicious
cycle.
And
I'm sure a lot of the young people are leaving,
many young people
which happens in most cases. Yeah. And it's a logical thing to do because if you can't get a job, you have to leave the country and perhaps send money in afterwards. But
exactly. And I mean, the whole healthcare system is really in a catastrophic situation because before the war, they were, you know, earning a good living. There was, I think, 800 hospitals at the biggest, 800 doctors at the biggest hospital in Tigray. And 200 doctors have left. During the war, during those 2 years, they weren't paid at all, but they were still working towards burnout, you know, no salaries. And then after the war now, they're getting 40% of what they were getting before the war, but there's inflation. So they really can't live off this. So over 200 doctors have left, which is just showing what's.
I mean, that's what
like
a to. Quarter, 25% of the doctors have left, and the rest of the doctors are working at on and getting salaries at poverty level. So, okay. I'm assuming that you aren't going to do an official launch of this documentary until you get accepted at a film festival, and that's when you're going to do the premiere. After that, I'm hoping you're going to use this to do lobbying.
Definitely. I mean, we are already me and Rita and Seb Lebok, our producer, who's fantastic as well from Tigray, we're working hard to get it in front of Parliament here in the UK and also organizing some screenings in the fall and during the summer in Geneva to really get it in front of the right people. That's an active campaign. And on top of that, of course, the premiere at a festival would be great. But this is really going to be a tool to hopefully activate change and activate these big players that can have an influence when it comes to the Ethiopian government, who to this day have not taken responsibility for the actions they have committed.
Well, Ethiopia is quite a unique country because Ethiopia, unlike all the other countries in Africa, has never been colonized. So they have an independence that makes them unique, okay, and less manipulatable, to use another word. So I'm not surprised, and they're also a rich country. They've got a lot of natural resources, which a lot of other people want to get in. In the DRNC, they're doing it beautifully, taking their resources, but it used to be a Belgian colony. So I'm not surprised. So the more we talk about it, the better. The more hope
Definitely,
we have of getting at least humanitarian aid through. Veronica, is there anything? You will give me a website that if people want to contact you, they can contact you. But is there anything you want to say before we close?
Well, first of all, I just want to thank you as well for giving space to this story and to this reality of these women. And it means a lot that you care and that you give this a platform. And I really want to thank you, Magda, for your time and for listening and really being an active activist in this. So thank you so much.
I thank you for coming to speak with me, because I think not caring to me is not an option, and us worry about people that don't actually care. And let's not talk about Tigray. They don't care about people dying in Gaza. And they don't care about the Yemenis or the Afghans, which are conflicts they know about. They just care about their little family, which life is not like that. We're all part of the big picture. And if you're not well, I'm not well. It's as simple as that.
We're all humans
and we're all interconnected. Mm. And we're all entitled to live a life, a dignified life, and be safe. So to me, I'm glad I found another person that cares. And I'm sad that there aren't more of us. And let me know when you have your premiere and maybe we can support it in some way. And good luck going forward.
I appreciate that. Thank you so much, Magda. And if you want to follow us on Instagram, it's Not Ours to Carry. And on the website is notourstocarry.com. So thank you so much. Please reach out to anyone who would like to be in touch. And Magda, thank you so much. And I hope we can collaborate and do a screening in the future.
Absolutely. And I'll put the Instagram and website on when I upload this podcast so that people don't forget it. Veronica, thank you. And let's carry on caring, please.
Love that.
Let's carry on caring. And to the listeners, this includes you. Thank you, Veronica, and have a lovely rest of the day.
Thank you, too.
The first trilingual podcast station of Cyprus. Island Talks. Open. Diverse. Free.